right now. You know, the one when you walk in and it's right there, and it's got it has its own display case, is David and Goliath, a new book by the New Yorker writer Malcolm Gladwell. The book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. I don't know why I put this over here, because I want to look over here. There we go. Gladwell's premise is that we easily misjudge strength, and the things that we think are weaknesses can often be our biggest opportunities to make a difference in this world, to rise above whatever challenges we face. It's a really great, inspiring read. I had that cold, you know, that hung on forever a few weeks ago, and this was one of the reads I got in while I was in bed. It's a great read. His inspiration for the story came from the well-known story in 1 Samuel 17. The story of David and Goliath, a story many of us learned when we were children, and many of us, have heard, and we've heard the words like battling giants and facing Goliath. But it's the story of the Israelites facing one of their greatest enemies, the Philistines. And the scene is set with the Israelites on one hill and the Philistines on the other hill. And in between them is this great valley. And none of them want to go down to battle the other, because that puts them in the firing range of the other. So they're at they're deadlocked on either side of this valley, facing each other off, and no one wants to move. The Philistines make the first move, and they send down Goliath. And Goliath comes down, and he looks up at the Israelites, and he says, "Choose this day who you are going to send to fight me, just one person. If they win, then he wins, then I will be, and my people will be your servants. But if I win, you will be my servant." Well, this had the Israelites completely afraid, because you have this huge man with 100 pounds of armor on, and no one wanted to go and fight Goliath. And the story goes that the kid brother of a couple of the soldiers came to bring his brother's supplies, and he looks down in the valley and he sees what's happening, and he looks at all the soldiers and he says, "Why aren't any of you going to fight this guy?" And finally he says, "I will go and fight." And he's the first person that volunteers, and he makes enough noise, and so he ends up going and meeting with King Saul, and King Saul says, "Well, you know, you're the only thing we got, so I guess we'll send you down." And he tries to, and he loads him up with all this armor, and David says, "No, I don't need that." He said, "I've killed lions and bears with my slingshot. I'm going to just go down and use what I have." And David goes down and has the unlikely luck of killing this giant. That's the story I was told. Is that pretty much the story you were told? Yeah? The scholars tell us that it was a different situation than that. Some few people have read some biblical scholarship here, because it's always a different story. What they think is that Goliath had acromegaly, I think I'm saying that right, which is an issue with the pituitary gland, where there's an overproduction of the human growth hormone. And it makes you continue to grow throughout your life. The tallest man on record died at 8'11" tall, and apparently still growing when he died. And there's a lot of things that come along with this. Part of it is that you're just a little clumsy because you're so tall. And then it also causes double vision. And in the story, we see that Saul actually had a guide down there with him, likely functioning as his eyes when he was down there to help him see what was coming at him. But anyways, he was probably this really, really, really tall dude and really scary to anyone who was looking at him with all of this armor on. And he had this brute strength that would intimidate anyone that was going to go fight him. And we're told that David was just a young shepherd out in the field, and the kid brother, and really had maybe nothing to offer, and it was really a mismatch. But what scholars also tell us is that there was a category of warriors, a skill that you could have as a warrior, as a slinger. And that would be to take some rocks in a bag and to sling it around and hit someone so fast that they would not have any chance of survival. Slingers were the most valuable warriors you could have in your army. And so Goliath would really have had no chance if David was indeed a slinger. Malcolm Gladwell said it would be like a Bronze Age warrior meeting someone with an automatic pistol these days. And so the story is very different. David saw it in a different way. He saw what other people saw, this big man, and he knew that he had skills. He didn't have the brute strength, but he had skills. And he had something that could actually conquer Goliath. And what we also don't hear a lot of in Bible stories is that David was a very wily, smart person. He was not supposed to be king, but throughout his life and throughout his career, that's how he looked at every situation. Is he would look at a situation and not feel overwhelmed by it, but he would think, what do I have? What do I know? How can I kind of get around the situation a little bit and do things differently in order to get what I want? And that is how he became king, and that is how he often ruled in his kingdom. Think of it kind of like, in the American Revolution, we have the guerrilla warfare of the Minutemen versus the very skilled and big and well-armed line of the British Army. That was kind of how David thought, kind of how he ruled. And Malcolm Gladwell asks of this story, the David and Goliath story, what does it take to be that person who doesn't accept the conventional order of things as a given? What does it take to be that person who doesn't accept the conventional order of things as a given? He tells a lot of stories of people with conditions like dyslexia, with people who have had great loss and suffered deeply, who have chosen to deal with their situation in a different kind of way, have chosen to find in their weakness a strength that they couldn't have imagined. And he tells the story of a guy named Vivek Ranadive. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Vivek Ranadive grew up in Bombay, India. And his dream was to go to MIT and study. And he was accepted to MIT when he was 16 years old. And at the time, the Indian government would not release foreign currency to students to go study abroad. So he went and he camped himself outside of the Reserve Bank of India until they finally gave him about enough money for a quarter of his tuition at MIT and about another $100 in spending money. And so he flew over to Boston and then enrolled in MIT with just $100 in his pocket. He got his bachelor's there and his master's. He went on to get an MBA at Harvard, and he became one of the premier tech gurus in the Silicon Valley. He's now worth millions of dollars, and earlier this year, he actually bought the Sacramento Kings basketball team. He's a guy who knew how to work the system a little bit, how to look at a difficult situation and find a different way to do things. His interest in basketball came because he coached his middle school daughter's basketball team. And he was coaching in the Silicon Valley. His team was full of all these little Caucasian girls that were the daughters of Silicon Valley nerds who had no natural talent for basketball. And he's looking at them, and what he could never understand about basketball after growing up in India, where you played cricket and you played rugby and you played soccer, was why when one team made, and I'm not a basketball person, so bear with me, when one team made a goal, made a basket, why the other team ran to the other end of the court to wait for the other team to come down. And so his strategy was, you know, we can never compete with the long shots and the athleticism of some of these other teams. So what we're going to do is we're not going to run to the other end of the court. We're going to stay on those girls when they're throwing on the inbounds pass, and we're going to focus on getting that ball and stealing it and making another basket while we're already down here by our basket. And so that's what they did. And it completely threw off all of the other teams, threw off their timing. They didn't know what to do. Why are these girls guarding us? They're supposed to be waiting for us down at the other side of the court. And this team went to nationals with this strategy. But these little nerdy girls who could just barely make a layup, but were always by their basket, so they had lots of chances. They ended up going to nationals because they were willing to change the game. Being a church in 2013 in the Pacific Northwest can often feel like you're up against a lot of giants. I don't know if you've read some of the statistics, but in the rest of the country, about 60% of people claim some sort of a religious affiliation. In the Northwest, that number is 35%. We're the land of the nuns, where people mark on their religious affiliation boxes that they have no religious affiliation. Patricia Killen, who's a Northwest religious scholar, says that the Northwest is an open space, an open religious environment, where there's less social pressure or reinforcement for going to church. You know, I remember my friend who lives in the South one time said to me, you know, that there you have to choose a denomination, like I'm Presbyterian or I'm Baptist or I'm, you know, and I remember thinking, I was living in California at the time, which is very similar, thinking, I don't even know if I want to tell people I'm a Christian, you know, much less what denomination I'm a part of. It's very different up here in the Northwest. And then you add to that kind of that Northwest individualism, and then Bend, Oregon individualism, and then the fact that we pretty much live in an outdoor playground. It's a tough place often to do church and be church. And it's a different landscape, religious landscape, than when this church began, not just in Bend, Oregon, but in our world. The church has abused power. The church has had scandals. The church has been so concerned with getting people in the pews and making them say things but not being concerned about the way that they are living that there is so much to overcome. A few years ago, Anne Rice, the author, declared that she was leaving the church. She was a former atheist. Well, she had been grown up Catholic. She had become an atheist and then had gone back to the Catholic Church of her roots. And she got so disgusted that one day she posted this on Facebook, which is where all important announcements happen. In the name of Christ, I refuse to be anti-gay, I refuse to be anti-feminist, I refuse to be anti-artificial birth control, I refuse to be anti-democrat, I refuse to be anti-secular humanism, I refuse to be anti-science, I refuse to be anti-life. In the name of Christ, I quit Christianity and being a Christian. Amen. And she's not alone. There's a lot of us who have either thought of leaving the church for that reason, or we know many who have. Religious historical scholar Diana Butler Bass says, maybe the issue isn't that people are expecting less of the church, but that they're expecting more. After all the disappointment, all the misuse of power, the church has a lot of baggage around its neck and a lot of hurt to confront. Christianity maybe has to be different. The church has to be different. And we have to listen to those around us who are asking us for more rather than less. And maybe it's not coming up with the latest innovative strategy. Maybe it's returning to some of those very basic first things that got the church going. Love God. Love your neighbor. Be a blessing in this world. Follow Christ in self-giving love. Allow God's love to transform you. This is not an easy time to be church. It requires courage, A willingness to change and to, I believe, also that same game-changing spirit that David had against Goliath. A willingness to look at things in a different way. We can't sit back and do what we've always done. And it is a possibility that this may be a time of great opportunity. That like that guy at the rental shop, when we don't get exactly what we want, we may get something even better. This church here in Bend has a history of being willing to do things in a different way. It's in our core values where we say we want to embody that pioneering spirit of Central Oregon. That's in the DNA of this place. That's in the DNA. I think that's why this church is fairly filled still on a Sunday morning, is because we've been willing to innovate and willing to look at different things. We heard from Wendy just the one story of someone who is finding that she is loved, of finding hope, healing, and purpose through this church. And it's this pioneering spirit that Diana Butler Bass invites us to when she says the church needs to do four things. The first thing is to wake up, look around, take statements like Anne Rice's seriously. Look around this world and wake up to the different landscape that we're living in. The second thing is to discern, to ask the question, who am I in this landscape? Who are we together? Pay attention and listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit that is speaking to us different ways of doing things, inviting us into new things. Listen carefully. And the third thing she invites us to do is to imagine. Back to the David and Goliath story. How could this be done differently? How might this situation, which feels insurmountable, be an opportunity? How might what I perceive as a weakness actually be my strength? I love the story of that Donald Miller tells of in Blue Like Jazz, where I don't think I've told this story in Oregon. So is it Reed College that has the big festival every year? Yes. Okay, thank you. Sometimes my Californianess shows up. But he and his friends decided, in the midst of all of that debauchery, let's say, in the midst of all of these students that were partying and having a good time and consuming too much of substances that were not necessarily good for them, that they would set up a confessional booth. And they would invite people in to confess not the student's sins, but to confess the church's sins. So as students came in and said, oh, you want me to confess my sins? They would say, no, we're here to confess to you. And they would begin to confess the many ways the church has let people down throughout the ages. That's an example of looking at what could be a weakness. The way that the church is viewed, the way that people think of organized religion, and instead saying, we see this in a different way. This is an opportunity for us to just be more authentic, for us to apologize. How are some of those ways? That's in the kind of imagination. And there's positive things we can do as well. To think about what are the ways, maybe it's not about building our church and getting people here on Sunday morning, maybe it's about getting out there and being where other people are at, about serving our neighbors with hearts that are full of love and sharing that love outside of ourselves. What can you imagine could be different? The last one is to do. That would seem so obvious, but one of the reasons I'm Presbyterian, and maybe you are too, is because I really like to think about things. I really like to wake up and discern and imagine, but doing sometimes is a little bit more difficult. Actually getting out there and doing what we've prayed about and thought about, making it real, investing our resources, our time, our prayer, spending time every day thinking about how to bless our neighbors, learning to live with new eyes in this world. When we commit to an action, it may not be the exact right, perfect course, but when we start moving, that's when we begin to see the real action happening. That's when we begin to see things change. So do. This world is offering us stories of fear, of holding back. The government shutdown, the healthcare crisis, violence in our world. There's so many reasons every day, it seems, to hold back just a little bit, to not quite go all in, to just wait a little bit longer to see what would be the wisest thing to do. What we're hoping to do here at First Presbyterian is tell a different story, to tell a different story of investing all of ourselves in hope, healing, and purpose, to believe that it is our role to create spaces of grace wherever we go so that God can show up and fill others with hope, healing, and purpose. We may not get the story that we expect, but are we ready for something even better? We aren't writing, I don't believe, the story of the rise of the church in the 21st century. I believe we're writing the story of something much bigger. The story of hope, healing, and purpose rising up within us, within our community, and in the world. How are you called to be a part of that story? That's our invitation in these next few weeks to consider. Let's pray.